Welcome. First of all, welcome. This is Unsolicited Perspectives. I'm your host, Bruce Anthony, here to lead the conversation in important events and topics that are shaping today's society. Join the conversation and follow us wherever you get your audio podcasts. Subscribe to our YouTube channel to watch our video podcasts. Rate, review, like, comment, share. Share with your friends, share with your family, hell, even share with your enemies. On today's episode, I'll be interviewing Jo Weatherford. She's a therapist. She works with people on addiction. We're going to be talking about her life, addiction, recovery, and the work that she does. To all our parents out there, parental discretion is advised. There's some cussing. That's enough of the intro. Let's get to the interview. So like I said at the top, I'm here with Jo Weatherford. She's a TEDx speaker, therapist for people recovering from addiction, model, former model, but still model. Once you're in the business, you're kind of always in the business. She's here with me. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. And I like to start every interview with, let's get into a little bit about your background, a little bit about your upbringing. And then did that have anything to do with you getting into modeling?
That's a great question. So I grew up with parents that were both pilots and both alcoholics and very high functioning. So that's a big part of my story. And I do think that that influenced my modeling career because there was a deep desire for me when I was younger, especially for outside validation and attention. And so modeling was, in some ways, a great way to get that. And in other ways, the industry is very brutal. I mean, it is ruthless. It definitely impacted it. I started modeling, though, when I was 12. And in hindsight, this is really creepy, but my first job ever was modeling wedding dresses.
And okay. There's a lot of questions I have about that. That's
so many.
Weird. Was it because you were tall and you looked older?
I did. I mean, like, for those of you who can actually see me and not just listening to this, I have always had a face that looked 30, you know, like whether I'm 42, I look 30, or if I was 12, I look 30. So at the time, it didn't seem that strange that I was modeling wedding dresses. I kind of look like somebody that you would see wearing a wedding dress. That was my first, gig. And so I started off there and then I went into broadcast journalism, and my passion really was to report on the news and world events, and I wanted to go out and change the world as a journalist when I got hunted by Playboy. And at that time, the money was so good. There really was kind of a golden era of Playboy, and I sort of hit the tail end of it. It's really sad to hear all the accusations and everything that's come out since, but my experience with them was I was always treated with a lot of respect. I've been way worse sexually harassed in quote unquote like real jobs. I was always treated well. And so being an alcoholic and a drug addict and only needing to work a few hours a week in an industry where not only was it okay if I showed up high, but it was kind of encouraged, it was the perfect situation for me at that time with the tools that I had at that time of my life. Like, I would never do that now as I am now. And it's a beautiful reminder. I think we're all doing the best we can with what we have in the moment. And so that industry was a big part of my life until I went to rehab. And when I got sober, I got out.
Okay, we're going to get into that, but there's some things I need to touch on before we get into that. So your parents were both pilots, and you said they were functioning alcoholics. I'm not going to point out anybody in my personal family, but I know what a functioning alcoholic looks like. When you were younger, did you know that your parents were functioning alcoholics, or did you just think mom and dad drink a lot?
I don't remember thinking about their drinking a lot until I was seven. And mm-hmm. then I started really paying attention to why are they always drinking that? And why do they act funny? And then it was around that time I remember picking up a glass of what I thought was orange juice and mm-hmm. taking a swig of it. And, you know, it's 8 o'clock in the morning and it was a screwdriver. It was like straight vodka. So then, I mean, that was the moment my innocence around it was just shattered. I was like, oh shit, this is a problem. This is real. And even as a child, I knew I was kind of on my own, if that makes sense. Like it was a real reckoning moment for me. But yeah, both my parents were wildly successful in that industry, aviation. Mm-hmm. It's so common. A lot of them are former military. They have multiple days off in a row and then they go work, you know? So there's mm-hmm. a lot of things I think that contribute to it. Plus they're just very high achievers, dopamine, you know, junkies, adrenaline junkies. But yeah, they always held it together. And you know, I had a beautiful home to live in and my parents were at all my softball games. And I mean, so in a lot of ways, they really showed up for me in ways that I appreciate. And there was this darkness that stole a lot of moments and connection. And it was very, very difficult and confusing. And then, of course, most children do one of two things. They either never touch it or they become what they hate. And by age 12, I started drinking at a very addicted level. And I was a full-blown alcoholic by the time I was like 13 or 14.
So do you think that that happened because at the same time you're modeling? So you're entering in that industry. So obviously there's some connection between the two, but you have alcohol readily available in your home. Which was a bigger, if one was bigger than the other, contributor to your addiction to alcohol? Well, was it home, the readily availability, or was it entering in modeling?
Yeah, I don't want to blame the modeling. I was already one of those kids that felt I didn't belong. Mm-hmm. I was raised as an only child. I was really lonely. I was very isolated in a lot of ways from a lot of my friends. It came down to, oh, we don't trust your mom because she's drinking, so we're not going to let our kids go play over there. So I was dealing with a lot of that. And then too, I also believe some of it was my genetics. I mean, I just, I was cursed truly as far as the addictive gene. But then also seeing my parents cope that way, you know, like that was some of it was that social learning and then the availability of it. But then just push all of that nonsense out of the way. And it comes down to me because I went through a moment of heartache. I went upstairs. I made the worst jungle juice you could ever make, just pouring gin, vodka, everything into this water bottle. And I just started chugging it. And I was like, I'm home. And so I can't even blame my circumstances, my genetics, my upbringing, anything. The bottom line is when I had that first real drink, it gave me the relief that I had been so desperately trying to find through a relationship or modeling or whatever, right? It was that warm hug. It was that embrace that I needed so much. It filled that God-shaped hole for me. And so that's what happened.
And so you mentioned that certain friends' parents wouldn't want them to come and stay at your house because they didn't trust your mom. So it's common knowledge in your community that your parents are functioning alcoholics?
Well, and my dad really, you know, he would just tie one on. And when he really went, he went hard, but no more than anybody else. So, you know, because I go, okay, most people I know, like I live in Cabo, are functioning alcoholics. I mean, if we're going to get real with it. So it wasn't like his drinking was even out of the norm.
Right.
My mother's was concerning and people started to notice that it was not even the amount. Like, my mom would never get sloppy. My mom, too, I want to say this, is a badass. My mom was the first Hispanic commercial female airline pilot. My wow. mom is wicked smart. She taught aerospace dynamics at Embry-Riddle. I don't even know what that is, but it's really smart. Mm-hmm. My mom is a fierce, beautiful woman, and she got hooked by this. And yeah, I think people started noticing it. And so they didn't want their kids hanging out, you know, at my house. And then when I turned 12 and I started drinking, then I was the reason. Then it was like, oh, well, she's a bad kid and don't associate with her. And so I really went where I was accepted, which was with kids that had no parental guidance. They mm-hmm. were all doing drugs. I mean, it wasn't even because I wanted to. It was just like, that was the only place I found real acceptance. And there was kind of a freedom. I had always been a really great athlete and, you know, one of the popular people. And there's a lot of pressure with all that nonsense. So all of a sudden I was like, I'm just going to be a failure and embrace it. And there was just like, oh, it was like an exhale, you know, mm-hmm. the bar was then so low. And I needed that at the time. Honestly, I was tired of performing at such a high level.
But you say that, but you're not a failure, right? Because you entered in modeling at 12. You go on to broadcast journalism. And I want to talk a little bit about that. You wanted to be a journalist. And as somebody who originally entered college and this first major was journalism, I feel kindred spirit yeah. that connects us. Because it really is about getting to truth and stories. So tell me what was that like, the start of it, before you got to Playboy? And then I want to talk about how Playboy discovered you.
Okay. Yeah. So when I was a junior in college and I was making my little reels and doing all my fun videos for my journalism classes, I was in a fashion show and there was a man that owned a TV network that saw mm-hmm. me and got to know me and decided to hire me. So during college, I actually co-hosted a show on our local NBC that aired okay. primetime Sunday morning, 9 a.m. And it was called The Home Show. And it was really cool because we would go in and remodel these magnificent homes in Tahoe. So, that's cool. You know, $30 million houses on the lake and show mm-hmm. the remodel. But mm-hmm. my segment that I did was all about nightlife, spas, shopping. So I got to go and just do all of those things, highlight all the fun, girly stuff around Tahoe and Reno. And mm-hmm. I did a half hour segment on it. So it was really the dream. It wasn't serious journalism by any means, but it was so much fun and it gave me a lot of really good exposure. And it was mm-hmm. just an incredible opportunity.
So, and you're doing all this while you're drinking. Has drugs entered the equation yet? Or is it just solely drinking? Because this is an accomplishment. This is you being a functioning alcoholic, just as your parents were, but being accomplished while doing that.
Yeah, I was drinking heavily. I wasn't drinking all day, every day. That came later. Okay. But at the time, yes, I was drinking heavily. I would have those nights out where you're completely blacked out. You wake up in the morning, you don't know what day of the week it is. You have no clue what's happening, the shakes. I mean, it was bad, but I could show up sober and shoot still. So I was working sober at that time. And then partying my ass off at night. And I was 19, 20. I just bounce right back. It's just right. so resilient. But yeah, it was getting dark and I was starting to create a lot of shame. Just it's that old thing. Like, why do you drink? Because I'm sad. Why are you sad? Because of what I did when I was drinking. And I was really getting myself into a lot of sticky situations, acting very out of alignment with some of my core values. I had a boyfriend at the time who was a lovely human and I would cheat on him and just do like awful shit, you know, really. And so here I am in some ways shining. And then in others, I was just disgusted with myself, but I didn't know how to stop drinking. I also was never in denial. I knew I had a problem. I knew it was out of control. I knew every time I drank, it was going to be 15 to 20 drinks. Like there was no kidding myself, but I also didn't know what to do about it. And where I did kind of lie to myself, I think, was I really believed I would just grow out of it. Like there was this idea that okay, I'm 19, I'm 20, all my friends do this. Again, normalizing it, right? And that one day I'm just going to grow up and be an adult and become a mom and calm down. And what I realize now, especially at 42, is we don't grow out of shit. You either work through your stuff, you feel it, you heal it, and you change, or you don't. You double down, you get worse. You don't just grow out of most things. Like we have to actively participate in our healing. But at the time, all I knew was I was having fun and I was ashamed and I didn't know how to stop and I was just in it. So, but that was a great experience for me hosting that show. And I had a bright future is when I think back to that time. Yes, there was alcoholism. Drugs weren't that big. I mean, I think I did blow. Like I would go in these periods where I'd do cocaine for like 3 weeks, a lot, and then get so paranoid and like frazzled, I'd stop. So drugs weren't a big issue back then. It was mainly the alcohol.
Okay. And so your broadcast, you're doing your show, and then somehow Playboy comes into the picture.
Yes. So I met a girl that worked for Playboy and she connected me with them. That was how that happened. And I had never taken my clothes off to be photographed ever. I'd never applied nudes. I'd never, even my high fashion work, which I didn't do a lot of that. I'm not tall enough and I was never thin enough to do that. I was definitely built for lingerie bikini. That was going to be the market I was going to be in. And so it was really, really, really uncomfortable the first time, but it's kind of like that analogy of the frog that goes in the lukewarm water and then it just gets up degree by degree and it boils. That's really how it happened for me. It was like, oh, just take your top off. Oh, and then your bottom. And then, oh, we're going to do this. And it was a slow process, for me to be comfortable with that. But the drinking helped. Again, I would show up on these sets and be really intoxicated. There's no inhibitions and I'm just taking direction. And the best way I can explain it is like my soul had just left my body. And I really like this analogy. When you think about a essential oil, like a lavender essential oil, how do they make that, right? They take a plant and then they soak it in ethanol. So they take a plant and they soak it in alcohol and they extract the essence out of it. So for me, I was that plant. I soaked myself in alcohol and my essence left, you know? And so here I am, this like hologram of myself, just living in this outside world that's telling me I'm pretty, that's throwing money at me, that's, you know, all of a sudden I started getting filled up by that and I forgot what mattered to me. And there wasn't really a self there to have a problem with it anymore. So that's kind of how it happened. And like I said, working for Playboy, a lot of it was elegant and classy and respectful. And I don't regret it. Would I ever do it sober? No. So those, both of those things exist and I can look back on the experience and be grateful for the opportunity it gave me at that time. I don't know what the hell I would have done if I wasn't doing that. Really, I don't. I shudder to think I probably would have gotten in a relationship and let somebody take care of me. And that brings a lot of potential danger into a woman's experience. When you rely on a man for survival, they can do a lot and damage, you know, because you're kind of stuck. Which I found that out later in my marriage, but that's a whole nother story. So at the time, I mean, thank God I was independent. I was making money. I was able to take care of myself because as bad as my alcoholism got, that was the only way I was going to be able to do it. So, I mean, kudos to me for finding a way to make it work at that time.
Right. So how bad did it get, the addiction?
Multiple suicide attempts bad. Hmm. I really did not want to be around anymore. The depression and the anxiety and the hopelessness that I felt was excruciating. And it wasn't a cry for help. It was like, I genuinely didn't want to be here anymore. And I tried therapy. I had tried rehab. I tried so many ways to get sober. I would get 3 months or I would get 6 months or one time I even got a year and a half. And I just couldn't do it. And so talk about the most devastating feeling of when you've had any length of sobriety and then you go back out. Like, and unless you've had that experience, you'll never know the shame and devastation of those moments. And they just wreak havoc on your resolve and your faith and your trust and your belief that you'll ever, ever be able to have a different life. Every relapse is just gutting. And I try to work with people on that of not letting it be. Like, we never lose the time of sobriety that we have. We always, always have that. And the fact that you are in that energy, you're in that resonance of sobriety for a period of time means that that can be your truth. So I wish I would have had somebody really fighting for me, advocating for me, and telling me what I needed to hear, but I couldn't yet believe, which is, all of that time matters, and helping me reframe it more for the positive. And it's not like spiritual bypassing bullshit of find the silver lining and everything is great. It's not that. It really is powerful. Any amount of time that we have when we don't use alcohol as a coping mechanism changes us, and it's powerful, and we're learning, and we never lose that even if we go back out.
So I want to go back to some of these really dark moments where you have multiple suicide attempts. You're in this really dark place. When did you come out of it? Like you said, you had these relapses, but when was there a time when you said, okay, I'm done with this? Because you've gone from the point where you were younger and you said, I'll grow out of this. But now you've gotten to the point where you're attempting suicide. So where was that marker? Where was that point where you said, all right, I need to get help and I need to get help now?
So it was 13 years ago. And like so many people, my rebirth came from one of the darkest experiences of my life. I was dating a guy that played for the Yankees and I was in Tampa for spring training. He and I got in a big fight. We were at a nightclub. I tried to make him jealous. I got this other dude's number. So then I'm flying out early. I'm staying at the Intercontinental Hotel. I call this dude just to meet me for dinner. And that really was all I wanted. I just didn't want to be alone. So I call this random guy to meet me for dinner. And it was weird because I was actually sober for me. I'd only had a few glasses of wine, which was relatively sober as far as I was concerned. We went to dinner and I woke up in my hotel room in the bathtub. The sheets had been stripped. I knew I had been assaulted. So when we were at dinner, he had roofied me and then told the hotel that, you know, like whatever, he was carrying me up to my room. He had my room key, all that. So what's interesting about this experience though, and why it changed me, was it was the first time in my life I felt compassion for myself.
Yes.
Every other time, and unfortunately there were others, I was like, this is my fault. I brought it on. I deserve this. This is what happens to girls like me. And I would just assume all the responsibility. And this happens a lot when women or men are violated, because the energy of shame is created in that moment. If I perpetrate against you, shame is created. The thing is, the perpetrators don't assume it, right? So somebody's got to pick that shame up, and the victims do. So not only do you have, you know, the shame of the perpetrator that you're holding, but then the shame of what happened, and then the grief. And it just is so difficult to find yourself after those moments. But for me, I don't know why, I don't know how, I didn't cause it. All I know is that I felt compassion for myself for the very first time. And I didn't change right away, and I didn't go to rehab right away, but that was the opening. A seed was planted that maybe I could love myself, and that maybe I could heal, and that maybe my life could be different. And whenever I share this story, I remember one time I shared it at Auburn University, and I had a young woman come up to me afterwards and say, I loved your talk. But one thing I want to talk to you about is I've never had that experience. I was raped, and I've never felt compassion for myself. So anytime I tell this story, I just also want anybody that's listening, you know, that has that same experience of all I've ever felt is my own self-hatred, is like, you are so precious, and that wasn't your fault. And just know that even if you can't believe it, I'll believe it for you, that should have never happened to you. And I believe that compassion can come. And if it hasn't yet, just keep seeking help, you know, like therapists, coaches, plant medicine journeys, I don't care, whatever it is, like make that your number one priority, that self-love, that compassion, because that should never happen to any of us. So that was my opening. And eventually I went to rehab. I went to an aversion therapy clinic, which I'm so sad is shut down now. So you cannot get this therapy anymore in America. I do have the numbers of the medical staff though, if there's ever anybody that wants to invest in one, let me know. But aversion therapy, I show up, they inject me with this horrific cocktail that makes you have the flu. Chills, nausea, vomiting, and then you go into this little room and they fill a glass full of Ipecac. So if any of you have kids and they ingest anything poisonous, you know, you usually give somebody a tablespoon and it induces vomiting. I drank a water glass full of that shit. And then they start pouring you alcoholic drinks. So I'm slamming 20 drinks, vomiting like the Exorcist for just 20 hours. It's gnarly. And then at the end of it, they take you in a room and they soak a rag in alcohol and make you smell it. And you're just so sick, so nauseous. It's like the worst timeout ever. It was hell. And then the next day, they would take you in a small room and they would do a dose of propofol and truth serum. So propofol is what Michael Jackson overdosed on. But so what they would do is they would put me to sleep, but not all the way. And they would do counseling with my unconscious. So I would wake up an hour later and then listen to a counseling session that I don't remember doing with my unconscious. And when I was under, they would put affirmations like, you don't drink, you don't crave alcohol. So I did those two treatments alternating for 10 days. I walked out of there. I've never drank since. I've never wanted to. I don't go to meetings. I don't try. I don't miss it. I don't white knuckle it. I just don't drink. Just like I wouldn't pick up nail polish remover and drink that. I don't drink alcohol, but I don't try not to. It completely rewired my brain and it saved my life. And I will forever be grateful for that experience.
Well, we're grateful for you sharing that very painful story. Thank you. And so many people out there, not just women, but men can learn from what you just said and the recovery. But we're going to get into some of your work next. Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Bruce Anthony here, and welcome to another episode of Unsolicited Perspectives. Today, I want to talk to you about something that's been on my mind lately, the importance of staying hydrated and taking care of ourselves. Whether it's prioritizing our health and wellness, or gearing up for festival seasons, or just gearing up for whatever season or time of year, there's one brand that's been my go-to for all things hydration, Liquid IV. Speaking of health and wellness, let's dive into how Liquid IV can fuel your well-being. Imagine starting your day off right, feeling refreshed and energized. Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier is the missing piece in your daily routine. With just one stick, you get 5 essential vitamins and 2 times faster hydration than water alone. It's perfect for those early mornings, pre-workout boosts, moments when you're just feeling run down, or even after a late night or long flights. I absolutely love how convenient Liquid IV is. The packaging makes it easy to bring with me wherever I go. And let me tell you, it's become vital daily part of my routine. The flavors, let me tell you something, they're incredible. From refreshing sea berry and strawberry lemonade to classics like lemon lime and watermelon, there's a flavor for every preference. It's like a burst of hydration with a hint of deliciousness. Picture this. One stick of Liquid IV mixed in 16 ounces of water, hydrating you 2 times faster and more efficient than water alone. And with 12 mouth-watering flavors, you'll never get bored with your hydration routine. Plus, Liquid IV is packed with 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and of course, vitamin C. It's also made with premium ingredients, non-GMO, free of gluten, dairy, and soy. This is hydration at its finest. But it doesn't stop there. Liquid IV believes that access to clean and abundant water is the foundation of a healthier world. That's why they partner with leading organizations, finding innovative solutions to help communities protect both their water and their futures. It's incredible to know that Liquid IV has already donated over 39 million servings in 50 plus countries around the world. They truly walk the talk. Get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code unsolicited at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code unsolicited at liquidiv.com. Remember, folks, taking care of ourselves should always be a priority. So why wait? Head over to liquidiv.com, pick your favorite flavors, and experience hydration like never before. Stay refreshed, stay hydrated, and keep rocking those unsolicited perspectives. So, Joe, you get clean, but you're in recovery. You're constantly in recovery, correct? It's always a recovery. So you're in recovery and you go back to school. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, at the time I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do. But so often we teach what we need to learn, right? So I was really interested in psychology and mental health. I wanted to help people. Obviously, addiction was a focus of mine. And so that's what I did. I went back to school and I did my master's in human development and family studies. I actually worked in treatment centers. And I burned out so quickly. I really did. I went, oh my God, what did I do? I've been an addict my whole life. And now I put myself right back in that energy. I just escaped it. And now here I am. And so then I reinvented myself again. And I went to work for the university. And I thought it would be different with college students because they didn't have any problems. And I learned real quickly that is not the case. But what I will say about working with that population is they have more resources. They have more tools. Their addiction isn't that advanced yet, where they've had hellacious health consequences from it, so on and so forth. So it is an opportunity for earlier intervention. But I was humbled real quickly with the amount of trauma that these students were carrying and dealing with. So I was naive to think that that population was immune from the real horrific hurts of the world. And I worked with them, though. I developed a lot of drug and alcohol intervention programs and ran the counseling. And then I taught addiction courses for 12 years, which was the most beautiful way for me to stay connected to recovery and to give back and to learn. You know, I mean, these students taught me as much as I ever learned from them. I got to work a lot with athletics and Greek life, going in and having those real conversations about, you know, who you are and who you want to be and the highest version of self and how you're showing up in the world, and that cognitive dissonance of, you know, who I want to be is this, but how I'm acting is here. And how do we bridge that gap, you know? And one of the things I saw on the college campus that I do want to highlight, just the absolute man-hating that came out. Some of it, I think, was the Me Too movement. Some of it was a lot of things being exposed that needed to be exposed, 100%. But so many times the pendulum swings so far to the other side, you know, as society is collectively trying to find balance, that I was working with these young men and, you know, they thought they were all rapists and they were all bad people. It was just the education was very, very negative, where for me, it's like, young men are protectors. The conversation really should have been geared towards like rise into your power. And when you see that shit happening, do something, because people will listen to you. You are a leader. You have influence. You have a voice. Like, I don't know. So it was a really interesting time in academia right then, you know. All of a sudden, campuses are needing to investigate sexual assault. And there was just a lot in the field during that time. So I'm really appreciative of it. I loved my time there. And I also, I was kind of coming to an end with it when COVID hit. And that, everybody's got a COVID story. But mine, I had been teaching online for 5 semesters. I was over it. My ex-husband and I owned a very large martial arts school. We had 700 students when COVID hit. And I was like, oh my God, this doesn't come back. You know, what made us special, having 100 kids in a, you know, training together, is going to be our detriment. Like, people are not going to want that now. And so my ex and I made the decision to just sell everything. We sold our home, building, business. I quit the university, sold cars, furniture, everything, and moved to Mexico. And it was at that time, I took a couple years off trying to think like, what do I really want to do? And how can I best be of service in the addiction field? And so what I do now is I go and I speak. I advocate a lot for harm reduction, and I go and speak to police and courts and Supreme Court justices, advocating for treatment over punitive sentencing and drug courts around the country. So I love going and speaking on addiction. That really is my passion, to get out there and speak. With my clients, I do much different work one-on-one. I have a couple that battle addiction, but that's not really what we're working on. My main work is on intimacy. So really dropping into our hearts, living from that space, emotional intelligence. But my one-on-one coaching is that. A lot of work with couples, deepening intimacy. How do we explore conflict through the lens of, I love you, I choose you, you're my partner. How do we get attuned first, create a safe space so that our defenses aren't getting flared and abandonment issues aren't getting worked up? You know, how do we create a safe container to then be able to have really honest conversations? And that goes back to the journalism, the storytelling, you know, like, right. How can we create such a intact, safe dynamic between two people that they can speak their truth and be heard? It's really magnificent.
So I have a theory, and you can disprove it or back it up. I'm just going to put it out there. Okay. That people that suffer from addiction, and there are a variety of forms of addiction, right? I know somebody personally who's addicted to working out. That these forms of addiction come from a place of them internally not being safe, not feeling safe. They be safe physically, emotionally, or mentally. And so it seems like what you're doing with those clients is trying to make them feel safe in their emotions so that they can share. Because not being safe in your emotions can lead to escape. Like escaping to a bottle or escaping to pills or escaping to anything that can be destructive, and anything can be destructive when you do too much of it. So what do you think about that theory? Does that hold water, or is that like, Bruce, I don't know what you're talking about that.
No, I love how you articulate that, and I completely agree. I mean, for me, addiction is a maladaptive coping mechanism. It starts with the intention of safety and pleasure and feeling okay within ourselves. And the problem with most addictive, whether it's substances, you know, behaviors, whether it's porn, shopping, working out, whatever it is, right, is it works until it doesn't. So there's a point of diminishing returns. But whatever feeling we're trying to create or avoid, the thing does successfully initially. Like for me, when I drank, I finally felt at home in my body, and it's all nervous system regulation. I mean, when we talk about safety, that is an intact, regulated nervous system. And so I can become the world's greatest pharmacist when my chemicals, my adrenaline and my cortisol are jacked and I'm trying to calm down. I can take these substances and I can manipulate my own chemistry, you know, and it's so fascinating though, when you look at what substances somebody is using, you know, if it's a stimulant, what experience they're trying to create versus the depressant versus porn or anything else, right? But I love how Gabor Mate says, we need to start asking what's right with the addiction. Because when we can reframe it into that standpoint of what does this do for you? What is the experience you are looking to have that this creates, granted with horrific negative consequences? What is it you're looking to feel? And then how can we recreate that in a way that doesn't have such dire negative consequences? Yeah. But I really believe it. Every addiction originates in pain. And it all comes from wanting to start feeling something or to stop. And what's fascinating to me is when we look at the stigma, which still is so rampant in society. It's like, if I'm snowboarding, I'm in Tahoe right now, right? If I'm snowboarding and I break my leg and I go to the hospital and they give me Oxycontin because I'm in pain, nobody's going to look at me and judge me like I'm an addict and a bad person. Right. But if I'm going through a divorce and I start popping opiates because they give me peace of mind, or I start slamming heroin, all of a sudden I'm a junkie and a piece of shit. Even though it is the exact same substance, it's all opiates used for the exact same reason, pain relief. And if we take a brain image of somebody with a broken leg and put it next to a brain image of somebody with a broken heart, pain is pain. The brain lights up the same, and we're all looking for relief. And so if we can just stop with the insane amount of judgment, now I'm not saying don't, especially if you're involved with somebody with addiction, don't have boundaries, don't protect yourself, don't get irritated or angry or cut people off. I'm not saying any of that. I'm just saying when we really look at addiction, just having that compassion for people and go, yeah, I get it. Because we're all going through something and we're all looking for escape routes. And so certain people are going to be more inclined, you know, to go those different directions. But that is what it's about, is trying to cope.
So in your extensive work, going all the way back to working in rehab centers after your recovery, and to your work now, obviously you can't give specifics, but were there identifiable moments when you're working with people that that either gave you great, great joy or just broke your heart?
Absolutely. Some of the ones that break my heart the most are when I'm working with somebody moving the grief and trauma of death. It's so powerful to witness somebody grieve. And some of it is selfish, right? Because then as a practitioner, as a clinician, I get to sit there and I get to be humbly reminded that love is the only thing that matters. And all of this bullshit is simply just nonsense. But when you really get to tap in and somebody is so vulnerable and shares the experience of loving so much and losing someone, the finality to it and just that, the purest expression of grief in those moments. Yeah. I don't want to say it breaks my heart, because it also fills my heart to know that that much love existed. I have a client yeah. right now who lost his wife to cancer 2 years ago. They have 8 children. He is a beautiful man. He is running 3 companies. He is an exceptional father. And so getting to watch him make sense of this senseless experience, this woman was the love of his life for 30 years. You know, those stories and those, moments of connection where I get to really, really be with somebody in their pain in that way, those are powerful. But they're also my greatest joy. So it's the same,
right?
You know, because it's like somebody in their complete, like, there's just nothing that gets us more present than pain. And to me, the pain of death, and death too, can also be death of a relationship. You know, when my marriage ended, that's another form of pain when that person's still alive, but it's not the same anymore, you know, and you're grieving somebody that's still living down the street. It's very, very powerful work though. And if we can just learn to be with our emotions and not let them become, you know, our reality, like if I can feel my grief, not become my grief, channel my anger, not become my anger. I mean, these are our greatest tools for expansion. The problem goes, oh, I can't feel that. We shut off, we close off, we grab a drink, we get into another relationship. The inability to sit with and let these really transformative moments do what they need to do. I mean, that's the thing with my clients. I'm like, let it fucking have its way with you. Don't waste this, you know, because that is that next level up is so huge if we will just have the courage to sit in it, and it will not last forever.
Yeah. Wow. That's really dope and deep. So you also do TED Talks. You give speeches. Has there been a time where you've given a speech and you can see in a person's eyes that what you're saying is really resonating, and you're like, I know that look. I'm changing your life right now. Has that happened to you, and how does that feel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound egotistical, but it happens all the time, because the way I'm speaking about addiction from a place of healing inspires people, because it's one thing, you know, to be a dynamic speaker, but it's another when you actually embody what your message is. And when I go out there and I'm talking about, look, if I can do it, anyone can do it. And sobriety doesn't have to suck. You can have the most magnificent life, and people feel that, and that instills hope. So I get to have that experience a lot. And that's why I enjoy doing it, is because watching somebody light up in that way, there's no greater gift. I mean, that's compersion at the highest level, you know, feeling joy for somebody else's experience. But I'll tell you, my most interesting story was when I did my TED Talk. And of course, the whole point of it was rewriting the story of my addiction and finding the beauty in addiction, all this, right? And so the woman that went after me lost her son in Sandy Hook.
Oh, wow.
So backstage, if you can imagine, she comes up to me and says, I really loved your talk, and it was very inspiring, but how do I find the beauty in my 6-year-old being shot in the head? And this was 8 years ago, and I froze, and I didn't know what to say. I knew I still believed what I had to say, but I didn't know how to articulate it. And so I just gave her a hug and we just cried. But what I wish I would have said to that woman is this: the beauty was not in that act. The beauty is in your courage to go and talk about gun violence.
Wow.
Yep. The beauty is in the fact that that 6-year-old had you as a mother, such a fucking badass woman. I guarantee 6 years of love and connection and just a happy, innocent child And he didn't know what was coming. You know what I mean? And that life was cut short, and that is tragic and awful and just heartbreaking. But the beauty is in that little boy's life. And the beauty is in the lives that she impacts all the time talking about this and going out and working with other families that have lost their children. That is where the beauty is. And I wish every single day that I could have said that, but I didn't have access to it yet.
Right.
I just didn't. But that was definitely my most powerful impact moment after a speech.
Okay. Well, Joe, what's next? What's the future hold for you?
Great question. You know, I'm very much a believer in some psychedelic practices and plant medicine therapies for healing PTSD. I do a lot with my clients around microdosing psilocybin. I see phenomenal results. Not for everybody. Set and setting is very important. These are beautiful medicinal medicines, never to be disrespected or abused or taken carelessly. But honestly, when I think about what's next and what I'm most excited about, it is the work that MAPS is doing and all these other organizations to start making these medicines available to people in a safe way that there is intense integration afterwards. It's really, really important. But I'm actually leaving in May. I'll be in Nicaragua for 2 weeks doing Ibogaine, which is a shamanic plant medicine. A very intense experience, but I really want to go and do it because with the opiate crisis being what it is, Ibogaine can be a potential treatment option. So Ibogaine actually eradicates the opiate withdrawal and then can reset the receptors. And again, there needs to be a lot of other work. I think we get into trouble when we think anything is going to be this miracle cure, one and done. Like, oh, I did ayahuasca and I was fixed forever. And that's a dangerous message to tell people. But I do believe that Ibogaine is going to become a very, very, very important treatment, especially for opiates. And I never talk about things I haven't done myself. So I'm going to go get my ass kicked in Nicaragua for 10 days so that I can come out and speak about it, because it's really, really unbelievable what is happening. And fentanyl has been so hellacious, but there is a new substance that just hit America. And sadly, I know about this because my dear friends lost their son. And this young man tried to be as responsible as possible. He tested for fentanyl. He bought drugs on the dark web. They came back, no fentanyl. Everything should be fine. He took a couple pills, started not feeling well. Friends watched him, you know, okay, a few hours later, yeah, not feeling great, but okay, no problem, and never woke up. So it took 4 months for the autopsy, because this is a brand new synthetic opioid. Because, you know, that's what these assholes do. They just manipulate the molecular structure. And so then you can't test for it. It's a new substance. Well, this new one that just hit America, he was the fourth death. So they just figured out what it is. It is anywhere from 100 to 800 times more powerful than fentanyl.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's scary. And you know, I don't like scare tactics. I don't believe they work, but you just cannot buy drugs anymore. And it's like, it sucks. I feel bad for you. I can't imagine being a teenager and being like, you know what I mean?
Hold on. To all the kids out there that could be listening, we are not encouraging you to go use drugs. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is, back in the day, you know, you could get some drugs and know what you was getting, but now you just never know. It's a crapshoot.
Yeah, like 100%. You can't ever, not one time, ever do it, because this stuff is everywhere. And people are cutting. They're always going to prioritize money. And I used to think, like, why would a drug dealer want there to, I mean, if somebody died from your product, you think that that would kind of like kill your business. And it's actually the opposite. So when I was working at the university, yeah, we would have deaths from fentanyl, and it would actually, like, then people knew that these people's supply worked. I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, this is so unbelievably twisted. So, I mean, God bless you. You just can't do it once. You don't get to have that experience like we did.
No, you can't take it back. You can't take it back.
Yeah, we cannot undo that. Healing is always possible, except death. And I mean, yeah, it just, you cannot mess up one time.
Yeah, no, I don't think they discovered that the healing from death. Well, they theorized as zombies, and I don't want to live that life where the healing from death is zombies walking around. But on a serious note, what would you like to leave the audience with today?
Yeah, learn to sit in your stuff. You know, we can talk about get into therapy and go do this retreat, or cut back on work, or eat better, or move your body, and all these things, which are very important. We need to be doing all of those things. And being able to sit in your shit and just get uncomfortable and learn how to hold yourself in that, that is the real medicine. If I can be feeling anxiety or grief or shame, and I can hold myself with reverence while feeling those emotions, that to me, that's interesting. That's what I want. That's how you become indestructible, because life is going to life and humans are going to human, and you're going to get your feelings hurt and things are going to go well and then they're not, and you're going to be on top of the world and then you're going to deal with death. I mean, everybody is going to lose the people that they love. I mean, we don't like to think about this, but we're the only species that knows it's going to die. You know what I mean? That's a big burden to carry. Like, so yeah. We are going to be faced with intense emotional pain. So when those opportunities arise, be with it, feel it, move it through your body. And the thing with trauma is this: when it is witnessed by somebody compassionately, it can flow out of us. It doesn't become a hijacking, crippling experience. You know, find somebody that you love that can meet you there, that can hold you, but have the courage to feel it and have the courage to get uncomfortable. We are not meant to be happy all the time. That is a social media advertising illusion. We are complex, dynamic beings, and we are meant to feel pain. We don't need to suffer, but pain is there to tell us when we need to make a change or when we need to grieve. Like, I'll give you an example. I'm in a marriage. It's not going well, and I get insomnia. So what do? Instead of going like, wow, there's something not working, I need to investigate with truth, I need to deepen into what's really going on, I start medicating myself so I could sleep. So now all of a sudden I'm sleeping, I've just eradicated the symptom, but I missed the message. All of our emotions are messages to help us get back into alignment. Nobody likes to feel unpleasant emotions, but if we can get in them, learn what we need to, adapt, take that next right action. I mean, that's freedom. And that for me is my most important thing. Being an addict for so long, freedom is my jam. And I will commit to that. And if it takes me 30 days of sitting in hell to get there, I'm for it.
I love that. I know the audience will love that. Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. This was a really good and important conversation that I know that my audience is really going to enjoy, embrace, and learn from. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Once again, you can find Joe Witherford's information in the description section below and both the audio and video platforms. You can go on our webpage at unsolicitedperspectives.com. She has a profile page. Click on her profile page. Go follow her on Instagram. If you know somebody or if you need some work, some help in your recovery and dealing with your addictions, give her a call. This was a really, really interesting conversation. I want to thank Joe for just being so open, honest, and candid about her past, her addictions, and her recovery. It's beautiful when people tell you their depths and how they rose through it. I feel like it's an inspiration to those who either are going through it or have gone through it, that there's light at the end of the tunnel. And there is. I know there are times where things seem like they're at their darkest, and you don't know how you're going to make it through, but you can, you will. And I love the fact that she expressed, don't become your grief. Embrace grief, but don't let it become you. Embrace anger, but don't let it become you. I think that's a really, really good lesson to learn and just dealing with problems that arise in our life. So I can't thank Joe enough for coming on, once again, being so open and so candid and just giving game. You know, that's what the kids say in the streets, giving game, you know, giving life lessons that you can really learn and grow from, and that can help with anything that you're going through in your life. Because addiction isn't just drugs and alcohol. You know, I've had enough people on here talking about addiction to let you know that addiction can be a variety of different things, right? I talked earlier about how I have a friend who's addicted to working out, just addicted to it, to the point where I say, hey, you need to be careful, or you're pushing yourself too hard. There is a thing. That is a thing. You can put yourself to the point where you're harming yourself, even if what you're doing, the initial activity, is healthy. So yes, there's addiction, and there's a reason why you're doing the addiction, and it's important to address that underlying issue that's leading you to do these things. But yes, this was another fantastic interview. Had a string of them lately. Had a string of really, really good interviews with people that can really give you some game and that you can really learn from. And Joe is at the top of the list of those people that just really good interview and had a really important story. So I can't stress it enough how grateful I am for her to come on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be it for us today. I want to thank you for watching. I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, as always, I'll holla. Woo! That was a hell of a show. Thank you for rocking with us here on Unsolicited Perspectives with Bruce Anthony. Now, before you go, don't forget to follow, subscribe, like, comment, and share our podcast wherever you're listening or watching it to it. Pass it along to your friends. If you enjoy it, that means the people that you rock with will enjoy it also. So share the wealth, share the knowledge, share the noise. And for all those people that say, well, I don't have a YouTube. If you have a Gmail account, you have a YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can actually watch our video podcast. But the real party is on our Patreon page, After Hours Uncensored and Talking Straight-ish. After Hours Uncensored is another show with my sister. And once again, the key word there is uncensored. Those are exclusively on our Patreon page. Jump onto our website at unsolicitedperspective.com for all things us. That's where you can get all of our audio, video, our blogs, and even buy our merch. And if you're really feeling genuine and want to help us out, you can donate on our donations page. Donations go strictly to improving our software and hardware so we can keep giving you guys good content that you can clearly listen to and that you can clearly see. So any donation would be appreciative. Most importantly, I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you for listening and watching and supporting us. And I'll catch you next time. Audi 5000. Peace.